Today, we're delving into a few major national conversations. The first, the recent fatal shootings of Black men by police officers and how that's again changed the dialogue for African Americans.
So we talk a little bit about how to engage in those activities and stay safe. We talk about making sure she's with a diverse crowd so that she's more likely to be safe and less likely to be victimized.
That's therapist and counselor Karen Sims talking about her daughter. We'll talk to her and Chicago poet, educator, and activist Mario Smith. Plus, how are statements made during this election season changing conversations around immigrants and refugees in the U.S.? And finally, why is it that people from low-income Chicago communities that are predominantly African-American or Latino have a greater chance of dying from cancer? And how much of this is also the case outside of Chicago? We'll talk with Illinois cancer researchers who work in both urban and rural areas to learn what can be done about it. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is the 21st. Keith Lamont Scott, Terrence Crutcher, two more Black men fatally shot by police. And we've been hearing those names and rallying cries and hashtags since their deaths. While there's still so much we don't know about their deaths and what happened, one in Charlotte, North Carolina, the other in Tulsa, Oklahoma, more will likely come out over time. What is clear is that these deaths have again raised more questions and more conversations about why this keeps happening. We're seeing that outrage, frustration, fear, sadness everywhere, but especially within the African-American community. Today, we wanted to hear more about that conversation as it happens right now, have some of that here on our program, and as always, invite you into this conversation. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. We wanted to start with Mario Smith. He's a radio host, a poet, an educator, and activist from Chicago. He's also the father of a 23-year-old man. Mario, thank you so much for talking to us. Welcome to the 21st. It's great to have you here.
Nyla, this is cool, man, and thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you being here, and I appreciate you sharing, because I know this is such a difficult conversation that's happening right now, Mario, and I'm thinking about you. I've seen your posts about this on Facebook. As a Black man in America right now, as a father, I said, to a 23-year-old Black man, how much do these police shootings of men who look like you, how much does this weigh on you on a daily basis?
Well, I think the analogy that has been kind of popping up in my mind is it's like a game of Russian roulette. Who's next? And coupled with that, here in Chicago anyway, and I guess it's not just here in Chicago, although you would think so if you watched the debate last night. Here in Chicago, there is an ongoing battle between citizenry and police, the level of mistrust, and watching what's happening around the country, the Terrence Crutcher, his car had broke down, and he complied. He did everything they asked him to do and then some, and he still ended up dead. So my conversations with not just with the 23-year-old, but with all young people that I run into, my nephews, my nieces, people I work with that are younger than me, I'm like, you know, what we talk about is, what do you do if complying isn't enough in the eyes of the police? What do you do? So it is heavy. And to say it isn't heavy, I would be lying. It's heavy on me and most of the brothers I know. It's heavy. And us trying to figure out what is it you want us to do when we see the police, it's an ongoing dialogue. And I know as necessary as that dialogue is, there's also the dialogue of, what should the police do when they see someone, you know, of color or otherwise? What part of their training begins and ends with shoot? And it's very troubling.
Mario, and when we think about that, there are so many conversations within this, right? We can't say a conversation because you've just mentioned all of the different ones. But I want to focus on you for a second and on that internal conversation, because you said to me something earlier before we were on air. Is this something, how often is this something that you're thinking about?
Oh, every minute, every day. In safe places. When I live in Hyde Park here in Chicago, and Hyde Park is, for the most part, it's relatively quote unquote safe. But when I leave my building, when I'm walking down the street, I'm thinking about it. I was having a conversation with someone on one of the main streets here in Hyde Park, and a cop got out of his car to listen to our conversation. And I don't know what his intent was, but he was in our conversation without actually being in it.
He got out of his car to listen to you?
He got out of his car.
Okay. And you were just on the street talking?
Yeah.
Okay.
Standing on the street talking to a friend of mine. This is part of the conversation internally that I have is, okay, I see them. They see me. I know a bunch of them. Still, though, you know, I don't know what they're going through. When I go home, I'm always glad that I make it home. I don't want to confuse people and have them thinking that I walk around in fear, because I do not, because that's not healthy. But what I am is concerned, because you never know. You don't know. I mean, Terrence Crutcher is the example. There has ever been an example of doing what you are told and still being murdered by the police. It's a thing. It's a real thing.
Well, and Mario, when I think about this, you've been talking about this on the air for years on your programs. I'm thinking back to conversations you and I have had over the years. I'm thinking about Trayvon Martin, how long you and I have been having. But I want to ask, how does this change for you every time there's another shooting? You mentioned Terrence Crutcher, Keith Lamont Scott.
It gets more and more aggravating, and it's very difficult to continue to navigate in this country knowing that the supremacist nature of the police is not to, and it's never been to police, it's been to control. If now you're saying to me that the controls have gotten out of control, and there's no one that can sufficiently rein the police in, not to mention the money that has been spent to militarize the police across the United States, that I don't know what the end game is, nor do I know what the solution is. And that is the compounding part. That's the part that makes it difficult to watch another man, and I don't want to diminish it by saying regardless of what color he is, but the fact of the matter is another human being murdered at the hands of a policeman or policewoman around the United States, and in those cases, the ones, especially particularly the ones where there's no weapon. I mean, Sandra Bland, same, all of it. It's troubling. And if we don't have a solution to this problem, then where does that end? What is the end game?
I'm speaking with Mario Smith. He's on the line with us from Chicago. He's a host of the podcast The Clock is the Enemy. You can catch him coming up on his new show that's going to be coming out on Lumpen Radio soon. News from the service entrance is going to be back on the airwaves in Chicago. We're talking about conversations that are happening in many African-American communities after the latest shootings of black men by police. If you're talking about this, whether it's online, through social media, or in real life, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. Robert King in Champaign says to us, "Good morning. As half of a parent duo, I find these events troubling. I do try to push a safety message. My inquiries are exploratory. I explore the take on the issues and speak honestly about how we black people are perceived. There's no clean way to express my love and fear, so try to focus on how they will manage a situation if nothing happens. I want my kids to love everyone, but to recognize it's okay to shout Black Lives Matter and march for a better society and community. Thanks for the platform," Robert says. Everyone else can tweet to us. Those were tweets from Robert. You can join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Also with us now is Karen Sims. I want to welcome her as well. She's a licensed therapist and counselor. She works with families and communities in central Illinois and Indiana. She's on the line from Indianapolis. Karen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining our conversation as well.
Hi, welcome, and thank you, and it's a really important conversation.
Well, and as you're working with communities, I wonder how much you hear similar conversations about what we just heard from Robert, about what Mario has been sharing with us.
So, absolutely, and so, you know, it's a twofold conversation. People are definitely impacted about all of the incidents that have been reported about police action shootings and that has significant impact on people who are, you know, ascribed in a role of safety or perceived as not keeping you safe. So that creates like a lot of stress. And then people are also concerned about the variety of traumas that are happening sort of on a continuous basis that kind of creates this vicious cycle of not feeling like, right, not finding a safe home anywhere. Like the people who are designed to keep you safe don't necessarily, right, in terms of the imaging, aren't keeping you safe. And then in your neighborhoods and your communities, there is a hyper sense that you can't be safe there either. So it's a really complex issue.
Mario, I mean, as you're thinking about this, as you're thinking about how you process this, I mean, how do you, I mean, because you talked about a lot of things, Mario, right? Because you talked about how this is happening. You talked about the emotions around it. You talked about how difficult it is that it doesn't seem like there are solutions in sight. Mario, do you think that's an accurate way to describe how you're feeling right now?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, look at what's going on. Since Colin Kaepernick took a knee, what is it? 15 more people have been killed by the police, maybe more than that. If you read The Guardian, they have a section that they call The Counted of the number of police shootings in America. Those numbers keep going up. They're not going backwards. So if not a feeling, I don't want to say of helplessness, but if not a feeling of what is going on, and of which I imagine not just African-Americans are feeling, everybody's kind of like, what's going on? If you don't have a solution to a problem, that's a bigger problem. So, yeah, I am concerned that the Department of Justice does the dog and pony show where they come to a town and they say, okay, we're going to investigate, but no one gets indicted. And that the reflection of that reverberates. That's not just an isolated feeling. Everybody sees that. I wrote on Twitter not too long ago, and I guess the poet in me wrote on Twitter not too long ago, America doesn't own mirrors. If America owned mirrors, it would be able to see the reflection of what the rest of the world sees. The world is watching us and watching how we treat each other and watching how African Americans and people of color are being treated by the police. So if the world is seeing it and they see it as bad, but in America it's just it's a conversation about an athlete taking a knee for an anthem, you know, we've got our priorities kind of mixed up. So, yeah, on many levels, this is concerning.
You know, Mario, you mentioned that Guardian link. The Guardian is actually, according to that tally, counts 798 people killed by the police in the U.S. We're sending that all. We're tweeting that out so everyone can see that if you follow 21st Show. But to that point that you're making, Karen, I wonder, as we're talking about that, how you think, I mean, what kind of effect do you think that the stress and all of these things that we're talking about, that Mario's sharing, that lots of people are sharing, what kind of thing effect do you think this has on people day to day?
So, you know, this is unfortunately science. So it creates hypervigilance, increased high levels of toxic stress. So that impacts you biochemically. So it releases cortisol, like all of the stress hormones are just increased, and this isn't even on a conscious level. Your body just sort of reacts to all of the everyday stress. But as Mario talked about, people who are chronically, constantly looking over their shoulder, feeling like there's something that might happen or they just don't feel safe, that sort of looking over your shoulder, imagine sort of carrying that weight all the time, that hypervigilance just adds to levels of stress. Right, that impacts the body, mind, and spirit all the time. And it has a psychological consequence, it has emotional consequences, and it impacts communities. So, I mean, the cost of these kinds of incidents are really, really significant, and we can't minimize the sort of social cost of that and the healthcare costs.
Karen, how are you seeing these impacts in communities and work you're doing? I know you're doing work all across Central Illinois and Indiana. What are people telling you?
Well, so, I mean, we're having conversations about trauma because people are aware of all of the levels of trauma. And we're sort of talking about the biology of it and what people can do, some of what Mario's talking about, some of what you can do to kind of help heal and recover from trauma. So talking about it, having outlets, feeling empowered, looking for sources where you can feel empowered, because it's very tempting to feel disempowered when you, like, listen to the news and the media. So knowing what you can do, some of what the person who tweeted Robert said, I think his name was Robert or Richard.
It was Robert.
Said around, Robert talking to your children openly and honestly about what it is, how to be prepared, so that they can, right, so that they can't, the more you know, the more awareness you could have about where what your options are, the more you can have strategies to feel safe, even if the environment feels unsafe, the better you feel. So we see some social costs. People, we're talking to people about what you can do to deal with those social costs, particularly those social costs to families and communities and young people. But if you think about the police Jackson shooting, they haven't been just a young people issue. They sort of, you know, crossed the generational divide, right? So anybody, you know, under 50 could be suspect. From 10 to 50 can be suspect, right? That's a scary world. So communities are definitely reeling and aware of these kind of social costs. And the other thing that I wanted to mention is, law enforcement, and I'm not a law enforcement are also aware, although, you know, it's hard to believe that, but they are also aware that this is that something is amiss. So they are aware.
Well, and also you could also traumatized and also dealing with this violence on a day-to-day basis also.
Absolutely. And they are aware that there are officers frequently for lots of different reasons. We talked to, I mean, people think about implicit bias and their own startled response. We don't talk about the number of law enforcement who come with their own trauma, right? Like, we don't talk about, there are lots of reasons. Some of those are, you know, institutional reasons, but some of those are interpersonal reasons that need to be addressed. And so, yes, people are right, and communities are aware that law enforcement also needs to be a part of the solution. And it's a complete, right?
Yeah, we're going to take a break. When we can come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Karen Sims and Mario Smith. And you can join us, 1-800-222-9455. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. We're discussing conversations happening in many African-American communities after the latest shootings of Black men by police, the fatal shootings. If you're talking about this, whether that's online or in real life, you can join our conversation we're having right now. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. My guests are Karen Sims. She's a licensed therapist and counselor. She works with families and communities dealing with trauma across Central Illinois and Indiana. On the line with us, she's online from Indianapolis. On the line with us from Chicago, Mario Smith is a poet and educator and activist. You can catch him on the podcast, The Clock is the Enemy. As we're talking about all of this, Karen, I wanted to ask you, because you're a professional, this is something, and thank you, by the way. I know you had a therapy session just before this and took some time out to be able to join us on the air here. You help people confront these issues, but you're also a Black woman. You're a parent. Your daughter is a young woman. How are you processing this, both yourself and as a parent?
Wow. So I can't. It's a challenging place to be. So probably the other thing to add is I'm a parent who is near 50. So there are some cultural, social things that are happening that make it really frightening. So when she listens to the discourse, right, when she hears conversations, it makes her worry about, I mean, we have to have conversations about how does she keep herself safe, how does she plan ahead, how does she, she's had friends who've experienced police brutality, and we've had to process that. She has had friends who have been impacted by both, they've been violated or abused or and beaten up, assaulted because of sexual orientation or racial issues. So she's experienced all of that, and she is 20. Mm. So it's a very scary place to be. And so we have conversations all the time about, again, safety and protection, and also and planning ahead. You know, like and that those are conversations that my mom, who, you know, was born in the 40s, had to contend with, that I didn't anticipate that we'd be having in 2016, but we have to have them even more. And that says something about the cultural climate that we're in not just here, but right, like these are conversations that are happening about brown people across the planet right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, so, you know, we locate this conversation not just as a U.S. conversation, but it is something that is happening to brown people. And so it's going to be very important for people of good consciousness right now to sort of ally with, who, you know, to be more honest about what's happening and not to see this as just somebody else's issues, because these instances are happening more often than not. So it's a scary place.
Mario, when we think about that, when we think about that talk that people of color, that brown people have, I mean, when you think about those conversations you have with the young people in your life, I mean, I can't imagine it's so tough how that conversation you think has changed even more. I mean, is there anything you can say that you feel like is what you can say that can prepare or have someone, have a young person be able to confront this situation?
Well, the main thing that I tell my guy and other young folks is don't talk to the police if you don't have to. Whatever you're doing, you should be in a position where you don't have to explain yourself to a police officer anyway, if you can, you know, help it. If you're in a situation, though, when you need the police, then you just need to really be plain with what you're saying and be very clear about what's happening. Unfortunately, again, even doing that is not enough, apparently, and you have to wonder what, again, I think, and Ms. Sims is spot on. It's a different conversation in 2016 for me giving it to someone than the conversation I got in the 80s when I was a teenager.
When you had it. Mm-hmm.
Right, you know, about what to do when the police come. You know, you do this, you do that, you'll be okay. And it's a different conversation. It's going to be a different conversation if we're not proactive in another 10 years, maybe not even that long, about what to do and about what's going on. One of the interesting things, though, I think that's happening is that governments are also creating an opportunity for more of these instances. And by that, I mean, here in Chicago, the Chicago Police Department is about to hire 1,000 more policemen. Mm-hmm. And 200 of those are going to be on the street detectives. And in my estimation, that's 200 more opportunities in Chicago for something bad to happen. I think policing, I think we need to really examine the areas that are being policed and what resource, and I know people don't like to hear resources as a go-to, but what resources do these communities have? If we invested as much in education as we do in policing and in the militarizing of police, I believe we could turn this around rather quickly. It's something that you and I have talked about in the past, Nyla. The police should be tested for various drugs and what have you, just to make sure that everybody is playing on a level playing field. When you have an aggressive situation in these streets, and I don't want it to make it sound like it's all police, because this is a dangerous time in general. There are people doing a lot of bad all over the place. But when you're in the middle, okay, my example that I always use, if I have to walk and I have to worry about the police, but I also have to worry about people in the community, that's a bad situation for someone that that doesn't have a horse in either race. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If I have to confront these two worlds that are colliding with each other, I'm in the middle. I am a man in the middle. And that's another conversation that my friends and I have. I'm approaching 50 as well. I'll be 50 years old next year. And the paradigm has shifted. Instead of really telling young people, yo, you know, be careful, watch your back, that's starting to be a message that might give my friends that are almost 50. Hey, man, watch yourself, you know, make sure you're good when you go out. It's a lot of things on a lot of different levels. And if I may add one real quick thing, what I try not to do is allow myself to watch any of the videos anymore of police exacting justice on people.
Mm.
I think that the trauma that is attached to those is also contributing to that weighed down feeling that you and the doctor spoke of. We have to realize that in the midst of all of this dark, there's a lot of light and there's a lot of good things happening in this world that don't get the same amount of attention and aren't as delicious as, you know, blood and guts journalism, if you will. Being aware that there is an epidemic or a pandemic happening in our country and around the world is definitely on the front, and we should be aware of that, but we also have to find a way to not all drive each other insane or to be driven that way by constantly watching over
and over
what's happening.
And to that point, Mario, Sarah, I just wanted to ask you one last question, Sarah. I mean, both of you, as you've said, as Black Americans contributing to this conversation, I'm sorry, Karen, I just, Karen, I wanted to ask you, do you have advice for people of other races who are trying to engage in this conversation, Karen? What would you say to them?
So a couple of different things, and I've thought about this a couple times. So one is to realize that this is our issue and not an isolated issue. So what happens to one group of people if you believe that it's an isolated experience and you don't personalize it, and if you're not also having conversations about these issues, like that, you know, when you look at the numbers and you say there have been these number of incidents where unarmed people have been shot, and you're not having those conversations in your home, then I encourage other people of other races to make it their issue too. And to be thinking about what are the, and Mario hinted, what are the policies and procedures, what's the why, like what's driving these things, and to use your, and so some of those are gun policies, some of those are policies around law enforcement, some of those are around training, some of them about resources, some of them about like housing issues, like there are a number of different issues that people need to be aware of and to be engaged on with their children, but also in their own lives, and to use their voice. Because as long as this seems like it's a Black issue, what we know about that is as long as it's segregated, it will just continue to fester and grow. I always remind, my daughter is involved with some Black Lives Matter protests down in Atlanta where she's at school, and I'm always reminded that those are movements with allies. So Black Lives Matter means that Black people have the first voice in the movement, but it is not a movement that is isolationist, because collectively is the way to create change. And again, I think any parent who has not had a conversation with their children or with their spouse or with their friends should go forth and do so and realize that there's some legitimate issues happening, and it's not, and to be curious about, if you walk away from looking at those stories believing like that the people are always at fault, wonder why. Like, be curious about whose interest does it serve for you to be apathetic, to see it as other, for you not to be engaged and involved, because these are, you know, these are all of our kids, these are all of our husbands, these are all of our family members, and how do we see it as us collectively?
Karen, thank you. That's Karen Sims, licensed therapist and counselor with Meridian K Consulting. I want to thank also Mario Smith for lending his story, his words to us. You can catch him on the podcast, The Clock is the Enemy. And News from the Service Entrance is going to be back on Lumpen Radio in Chicago next month. Mario,
yes.
Karen, thank you so much. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Register to vote.
Some breaking news, by the way. A federal judge today just scaled back Election Day voter registration for highly populated areas in Illinois. The decision sides with Republicans, who claimed in a lawsuit that last year's extension of same-day registration is unconstitutional. The move will temporarily block wider same-day registration lawmakers put into effect last year. Voters will still be able to register on November 8th, just not at individual polling places. We'll be keeping an eye on that story. Stay tuned to All Things Considered and news updates throughout the day. We'll be following that breaking news story that just happened here in Illinois. Now, speaking of politics, what are the trends driving the current debate about current immigrants and refugees in the U.S., particularly in regards to the statements that are being made during this presidential election? Cheryl McElmurray is the Assistant Director of Immigration Studies with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. She was in Champaign yesterday for the conference Immigration, Migration, Refugees, and the 2016 Election. That's still going on today, by the way, at the University of Illinois. She's back in Chicago, joins us on the line from Chicago to talk about this. Hey, Sarah, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning, Nyla. Thanks so much for having me.
Sarah, you were talking about yesterday, your talk centered around, for example, let me start with one thing, perceptions around refugees that are driving fears in this country. What are those perceptions that you were talking about?
Sure. You know, we've seen so much rhetoric cycling around with this election cycle around immigrants and refugees that's not actually related to the foreign-born population itself. It's actually being fed by some other fears related to kind of this notion of our government or our systems being unprepared to handle what people perceive to be large numbers of people entering the country. Folks feeling the effects of globalization. Certainly there's a pinch on being felt by the middle and working class in this country, especially here in the Midwest. And this notion that we're sort of losing our identity as a nation, this idea of culture change at the hands of immigrants and refugees.
Well, it's interesting that you're tying all of this together. It's interesting to hear that, like, all of this and how it's sort of affecting perceptions. I wanted to ask you about sort of just the reality. Your research is based on statistics and numbers in terms of the foreign-born population in the Midwest. What do the numbers look like when we're thinking about Illinois and immigrants and the economic impact across the Midwest? For example, when we're talking about Illinois, how does immigrants and the foreign-born population, how does that interact with the rest of the population and economy for the Midwest?
Sure. Yeah, our research here at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs specifically focuses on a Midwest agenda and a Midwest consensus around needing immigrants for a robust and healthy economy. So we tried to reframe some of those fears and talk about them in terms of the demographic and economic benefits to our region. And what we know, especially places like Champaign and Urbana and central Illinois, we know that the population, the native-born population, is shrinking. We're in decline. We have an aging population. We're at about 50% of our native-born folks over the age, between the ages of 55 and 65, rather, ready to retire, leaving large gaps in our workforce, which would cause problems across multiple industries in the region. Lucky for us, we do have 1 million immigrants who have arrived to our 12-state region over the last decade. These are legal immigrants of working age that are keeping our workforce healthy and vibrant.
And when we look at industries, for example, like healthcare in the Midwest, how much of the current workforce needs foreign-born workers, or how many foreign-born workers are in, for example, the healthcare industry?
Sure. We just looked at this in a report we released earlier this year. We've got some unique trends and challenges with healthcare in the Midwest. We're at a place where we've got shortages of, for example, primary care physicians and internal medicine specialists across the country. But those deficits are especially felt in the Midwest, where people graduate from medical school and tend to leave the region to seek work on either coast. And those trends are only exacerbated in rural areas. We've spoken to healthcare systems across the region who really are experiencing challenging hiring problems sort of at the top and bottom of their workforce. So we've got healthcare systems where one in four physicians are foreign-born, for example, and still have hiring challenges. Healthcare systems depend on foreign-born nurses and immigrants in lower-skilled positions in hospitals like data entry, housekeeping, cafeteria workers, on down the line.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Sarah. Sarah, I think everyone who's listening to this might think about the response that's been heard oftentimes during this presidential election cycle. Well, immigrants are taking other people's jobs. So I'd like you to respond to that when we come back, particularly when we're thinking about the healthcare industry. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm speaking with Sarah McElmurray, Assistant Director of Immigration Studies with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. She's been making the link between the political conversation that's happening during this election season and how much immigrants and refugees are being lumped into a conversation together, some perceptions and fears around that. Sarah, right before the break, you were just talking about the research the Chicago Council has done looking at What you say, immigrants being a demographic lifeline, particularly for the Midwest, particularly for Illinois. We were talking about the healthcare industry. How much of that current workforce is being represented by foreign-born workers? And I wanted to ask you, because I feel like there has been a whole conversation in this election about how much immigrants are taking Americans' jobs. I feel like we've heard that phrase oftentimes. What would be your response to that, especially as we're looking at these numbers with the healthcare industry?
Sure. And, you know, that fear that we hear about, this perception that immigrants are taking Americans' jobs, is really rooted in more the effects of globalization as a mixed bag. And there's been quote-unquote winners and quote-unquote losers as globalization has become a bigger force in our lives. It's made some folks very wealthy, but has also spurred incredible inequality and sort of the shrinking of the middle class. But rather than, you know, being able to point a finger at this very intangible force of globalization and automation and jobs going overseas, people choose instead to point fingers at immigrants, which are a much more tangible scapegoat. But just last Thursday, actually, the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine released a huge report, 550 pages, research from 14 leading economists and demographers that looked at this very question: are immigrants taking American jobs? And lots of analysis. The key takeaway was no, immigrants aren't taking jobs, and they're not lowering wages by working for less. Highlights from that report: immigrant workers are expanding the size of our economy by approximately 11% every year, and in 2016, that should work out to about $2 trillion in new wages and tax revenues. The report also sort of projected the effects of a pathway to citizenship, this idea of giving work permits to the 11 million unauthorized workers that are currently sort of boosting our workforces. And those work permits, rather than creating more competition, would actually create new jobs to the tune of 145,000 new jobs for Americans each year, and raising wages by about $625 billion over the next 10 years. So lots of positive news to share.
And Cheryl McMurray, sharing some facts, statistics, and data that she does as part of her job as Assistant Director of Immigration Studies with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Sarah, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Why is it that people from low-income Chicago communities that are predominantly African-American or Latino have a greater chance of dying from cancer? And how much of this is also the case outside of Chicago? That's a question researchers across the state of Illinois are working on. They're trying to uncover the reasons why this is and what can be done about it. This Thursday, a symposium on this very issue is being hosted by the Chicago Cancer Health Equity Collaborative. That's a group of medical researchers from the University of Illinois at Chicago, Northeastern Illinois University, and Northwestern University. We're joined now by one of those researchers. Dr. Robert Wynn is the Associate Vice President for Community-Based Practice at UI Health. He's on the line with us now from Chicago. Dr. Wynn, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Dr. Swati Potik. She's an oncologist and assistant professor at Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. She's on the line with us from Jacksonville at an outreach clinic where she works with impoverished cancer patients. Dr. Potik, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Wynn, what do we know about why people in low-income communities in Chicago are more likely to die from cancer?
I think that what we know is predominantly known by databases from Illinois, from Chicago. But in general sense, people know that folks from low-income areas, whether it's rural or low-income areas in Chicago, do less well. And that's for a number of reasons. For example, we know that the prostate cancer death rate for African-American men, for example, will be more than twice that of Caucasian counterparts. We can go on and on about some of the other issues around breast cancers, and you can look at almost every sort of cancer and look that there is a disparity, and that disparity is usually then compounded when there's less access to physicians, and those are predominantly in low-income areas.
Mm. Dr. Potik, is this the same thing true for African-Americans or Latinos with lower incomes in rural areas? We're thinking about Southern Illinois among your patient base?
Yeah, so, Southern Illinois, Southern and Central Illinois, we have like about 73 counties, and this population is less racially diverse But the level of education and the income is lower compared to Northern Illinois. We see a lot of cancer, result disparity among this population, and it is definitely poorer. We get poorer results in people who have a low income and low education. The problem is multifactorial, and it basically stems from lack of education, lack of early detection, and their long commutes and in this deprived population. So, yes, we do see poorer results and poorer outcomes in this population.
When you all have been talking about income and education. Dr. Pottick, is there also a genetic component to this also? Is there something that in terms of genes that we need to be paying attention to this when we're talking about African-American and Latino populations in cancer?
Yes. So we know in multiple cancers, especially in prostate and breast, women and men who are diagnosed with this cancer and are African-American, they have more aggressive disease. They're detected at a later stage, even if we discount the screening. You know, these women, they're going for regular mammograms, sometimes even more frequent than their white counterparts, and still have more aggressive disease and are detected at a later stage. The outcomes are poorer. And this has stemmed a lot of interest in research and finding if the pathology and the pathophysiology of their cancer is different from their white counterparts.
Dr. Pottick, I'm sorry, did you say that African-American women who are going for the same types of screenings as their white counterparts are still getting detected later?
Yeah, so the cancer, there was one study which looked at African-American women who were going for regular pap smears and regular mammograms, and still they found that their cancer was detected later. The disease was more aggressive. They were having more hormone-negative disease, which is has poorer prognosis compared to hormone-positive disease, and the rates of metastasis were higher.
And do we know why? Do we know why? Just apart from the strength of the unfortunate strength of the disease and those sorts of things, do we know why the detection wasn't happening sooner?
So when this disease probably is something that's, it's still an intense topic of research, and there's a lot of research going on around this. We don't have exact answers for this yet, but hopefully in the future we will be able to find out why. But again, in our population, the rural population, we see that women who are poor, who have less education, and this could be African-American and other rural populations, the screening is not as regular. Even if the cancer is detected or an abnormality which is precancerous is detected, a lot of time these women get lost to follow-up. And this gives a poorer result. Cancers are detected at an advanced stage, at which time the treatment might just be palliative.
I agree. And I was going to just add to that, and it's been said before, that your zip code probably is a predominant determinant of your overall outcome, even more than your genetic code, that's for sure. But within that genetic code, we actually understand that there are several big movements that are actually happening in the United States to sort of address what we don't know. For example, the Precision Medicine Initiative, which is announced by Obama. The state of Illinois is actually one of the first four groups to actually have that. And I'm happy to be with my colleagues at Northwestern and University of Chicago, a part of that as well, of trying to figure out exactly what the genetic portion contributes to the different diseases in the different populations. In addition to that, you have things like moonshot that, again, we are in the state of Illinois and part of. So it's kind of an exciting time to figure out the genetic component. But I don't want it to be lost that while the genetic component is certainly a driver, and as a basic scientist and a cancer center director, as well as the associate vice president of health affairs for community-based practice, I don't want it to be lost on people that the reality is that your zip code is a predominant contributor to your overall outcome.
And Dr. Nguyen, when we're talking about that, when we're looking at, for example, in 2013, CDC stats on cancer in women, incidence rates highest among white women, deaths highest among black women, you're talking about the zip code. We've been talking about income, access to health care, education. Can you explain a little bit about the goal of the collaboration with the Chicago Health Cancer Equity Collaborative? Because I know you've said this, the traditional top-down approach isn't working when it comes to reaching cancer patients of color, particularly when we're talking about impoverished areas in Chicago. What are you all? How are you all trying to change this?
Yeah, thanks for that. I think that it goes to exactly what you're saying, is that the education and the access are some of the biggest issues. But you can't educate and you can't actually have access from the sideline. So you have to really be part of the community. So with Melissa Simon and others, Dr. Mora from NEIU and our Northwestern colleagues, we are trying to literally be integrated into those communities, get the voice of the communities, and find out from the communities how best to educate and how best to sort of what type of access they need. In addition to that, we also are doing what any good academics would do, which is, you know, putting forth research, for example, around prostate cancer, breast cancer, the effects of obesity in the context of its contributions to cancer, as well as other factors. But the beginning and the end starts in the community. Unlike research that used to happen in the 1980s and 1990s, where you think of something in your ivory tower and then you go to communities, we did it the opposite way. We deconstructed it. We went to the communities and we got our community partners, and they have been, I think, at the foundation and the forefront of helping us develop what it is that we're studying. So that's why one of the things that I'm most excited about Chicago and the state in particular is that we have these very innovative programs of getting communities involved, not at the back end, but at the front end of these studies.
How are you trying to get the communities involved?
Well, the very first thing you have to do is you have to be present. And so all of the PIs and everyone that's involved with this sort of grant literally is meeting with them on a regular basis. In fact, we have monthly meetings. We have town hall meetings. We actually have disseminations meeting. In fact, the one that's coming up on the 29th is our annual meeting with the community that everybody's invited to, where we are going to disseminate the information back that we found over this last year to them. For example, most of the time when studies get done, things are being done to people, not usually with. And so they come in, you know, we examine people, we do our studies, and then the next thing you know, we're gone. They don't even know what happened. Well, you know, in fact, sometimes people in Inglewood and South Shore are sort of saying, okay, we had these people, we gave up our blood, we've done this, this, and the other thing, but what were the results? We're trying to make that easier by making sure that there's at a minimum at least an annual forum that everyone's invited to come. But more importantly than that is the regular routine, consistent sort of interactions, whether it's in Humboldt Park or whether it's on South Shore, whether it's in Inglewood, whether it's, in back of the yard, getting those people from those communities talking with us on not just that, but also with our navigators and with other people on a regular and consistent basis. I think that that's been the most helpful part about this Chicago check.
Thanks for that, Dr. Nguyen. Dr. Puttick, I know you're involved with a separate research collaboration also with researchers from Washington University in St. Louis. We just have about a minute left. I wonder if you could just weigh in on what you think rural communities need out of this. We've been hearing about what happens in Chicago. What would you like to see in different rural communities across Illinois to help solve this problem?
Yeah, so, what we've seen is that our rural population does require a lot of education, and there's a significant barrier to their enrollment in clinical trials and getting state-of-art treatments that are available only through clinical trials. We here at Simmons Cancer Institute are liaising with Washington University, and we just got our grant funded by NIH to study the clinical barriers to clinical trials in rural population. What we're trying to develop here is a decision aid which can educate our rural population not only in the trial that may be potentially a treatment for them, but also really talking to them and teaching them about what a clinical trial means and how it can benefit them in general.
Wow. So lots of education still needed on this. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's Dr. Swati Puttick, as she said, with the Simmons Cancer Institute at Southern Illinois University. I want to thank Dr. Nguyen, Robert Nguyen as well, with UI Health, director of the University of Illinois Cancer Center. That symposium is on Thursday, open to the community, said for folks in Chicago. We'll have all of the information on our website. Just a reminder for everyone, it is National Voter Registration Day. We'll have more in the newscast to follow about the breaking news about same-day voter registration in Illinois, the lawsuit decision that was just reached. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day.